different spirits inside talking, you know, about who they are, and, you know, different spirits, the animal spirits.
You're listening to the Sweetgrass Road, one of 32 narrationless voice escapes in the Earth Chronicles documentary series produced by yours truly, me, between 1992 and 1993. Here's the second half.
There are, I feel, all different types of little spirits in the rainforest. I think in all types of forests, even in all types of environments, there are these little, I don't know, interdimensional creatures that we can't see, but they can hear us. They know where we are and what we're doing. I've had experiences with them before. I was taught this some time ago that they were a reality and that they were here and that they tended the plants. They tend all the plants and the, you know, all the various life forms in the rainforest. I remember one time I was helping a friend who was hand logging way up the coast, and I wasn't really interested in doing this, but his worker fell sick and I happened to be visiting, and so I offered to help him out in this one day. I was way back up in the forest amongst some trees that he'd selectively logged or cut out of the rest of the forest, and we were having a hard time getting some of these monstrous tree trunks dragged down into the ocean with his tugboat. And so I in my rest time, in my break, I just sat down and started talking, called these little forest spirits and started talking to them, and I introduced myself and told them who I was and what I was doing, and explained my position, that I wasn't there to cause any damage, but that I was helping out for the day, and that if they could possibly help out by helping getting these logs down into the water with the least amount of damage, that would be, you know, overall beneficial to the area. And so when it came time to hook up the logs, I hooked up one of the big ones and talked to my friend over the radio and told him to start pulling, and he pulled on this one big log, and it started dislodging all the other logs, and we had four of these monstrous great trees just start sliding down the 150 feet down the hillside toward the ocean. And there was another fifth log that wasn't even anywhere near the proximity of the others that started to slide all on its own. And these are logs that are 50 feet long and up to 5 feet in diameter. And I was standing in the midst of all of these, you know, well off to the side of the one that I had tied onto. And it turned out that all five of these logs ended up right in the ocean without getting hung up. We had terrible trouble with it. And I was feeling a little bit smug about this. I thought, well, isn't that terrific? You know, that's just great. What a job! And all of a sudden, my feet were taken out from underneath me, as if somebody had just kicked my shins out from underneath me, and I went flat on my face. And I had a distinct feeling that it was a lesson to me to be. Not be so smug about, you know, they didn't appreciate what was being done in their forest, and that they would put up with it because I had asked and that I had been worthy, but, you know, I wasn't to be smug in any way.
If you really want to know what life was like, is you'd have to go and spend time with a trapper up here in these trapping lines that they have. Just go and visit and live in that log cabin that they do, and go out and follow him in his setting up his traps, and become part of our Mother Earth and part of the world around you, because to me that's where it is.
Well, I guess I started hunting when I was 16. 16 years. Yeah, I started trapping. Very little, very slow. And, you know, building experience. The correct way to hunt is, you know, it's not to abuse the wildlife. It's, you know, not to waste. That's one of the teachings of the elders also. That, you know, if you want anything for food, such as a moose, that only take so much. Not to you know, take too much for the night, you know, just so not to waste any meat and so on. So, and when there's, you know, when you kill one moose, then you distribute it to your friends, so no meat and nothing will be wasted. And that was, you know, the teaching of the elders. I seen on TV people going out fishing, hook a fish, tear the, you know, the gills out and throw it back in the water. That's abusing the wildlife. To me, that's not right. And we talked about it many, many times, that how could that kind of thing be shown on TV? We don't do those things. When we take a fish, we eat it. And that's how it should be.
My name is William Dumas from South Indian Lake. Where South Indian Lake is? It's in Manitoba, just north of Thompson here. Every animal is referred to the term kanatiso. It means it is sacred. So from that ethical perspective, however you develop your hunting styles, if you live that philosophy that every animal that you hunt is considered sacred, so you hunt from that perspective, you know, that everything around you is sacred. Once the animal has been downed, how you clean it is very important. You know, certain parts that, you know, you don't throw things around. There's certain areas that are designated for putting these things. You know, instead of just throwing the guts and fur all over the place, you have to make the place clean, because kanatan also means making it clean, sacred and clean. So there's a connection there.
We eat everything in caribou, including we cross the bones to make a mokshan or feast, we call it. You know, we drink broth from that bones. After the bones are crushed, after they're boiled, that as respect to that caribou, we just take them into the lake and put the bones on the lake. It's part of the respect for the caribou. We thank the caribou. It's part of spiritual from the hunters. That's how they have done it in the past, and we still have that ritual that we have. And I think that that some people had powers from being a hunter. They can tell the future. Only the old Eno hunters have that power.
My name's Art Gordon, and I grew up hunting in this region. I've been hunting here probably about 20 years. And before that, as a child, I used to come out here with my father. We hunt deer, white-tailed deer. We take mainly does. We don't hunt for trophies. Generally, we hunt. Myself and my brothers hunt from late August to late January. You get into January, and then they're into their mating seasons. The does are pregnant, and we don't want to take pregnant animals. Not about to harm an unborn baby. And then, again, we don't start until late August, generally by the end of August, the young ones, the fawns, are old enough to care for themselves. They're able to feed themselves, and generally from there on, instinct tells them how to survive. In some way or another, we're always taught that good or bad, whatever you do, it's going to make its way back to you. And almost always it will. Sometimes if you're sick or hurting or lonesome or just not feeling well, you'll remember a deed you may have committed, whether it was bad or not good. Another thing, which is a real no-no, is to injure an animal and just to let it go wandering off and hide and die on its own. Well, we've always been taught never to shoot an animal and just to leave it. We always go find it, regardless if we have to come back the next day or whatever length of time it takes, just to find it, not to let it suffer. When we kill animals, we don't hoard it. It's shared with everybody. Everybody likes to eat deer meat, it seems. And we share it. We share it with everybody. We don't keep it to ourselves.
Well, I had a fine catch the other night. I had a fine catch when I was young. This is what happened to me. I had such a fine catch. I thought the more I caught, the better. Until I brought it home and I discovered that I had too much. An elder could tell you a simple story like that. It's got so much learning from it. Just about a simple little thing like that. You know that that person brought in too much fish, that elder. And now he's trying to say, don't take too much, you know. But make sure that if you do take too much, that you feed everybody in the community. You make sure you spread it out, you know. Don't keep it all to yourself. We have that system here, whether or not the Georgina Island people know this. They have that system here. Just the other day, somebody was fishing and brought us 3 whitefish because they had too much. We didn't know these people. We didn't do anything for them. But yet they brought us some fish. And that's also respecting us because they know we're busy people and we don't have time to go out and fish. And they brought the fish to us. Now that system, whether or not they know it, is still being carried on.
My name is Joseph Iron. I'm from Canoe Lake in Saskatchewan. Maybe I was about 15, I think, since I started hunting. That was a caribou country up here. Also, the moose, there was a lot of moose and deer, all kinds of the animals. But since they started building roads, like, then the seems like the moose and the other games are going the other way, you know. They're going, they left the country here, like. And I remember one time I was hunting, we were hunting caribou. I killed 6 caribous in one day because there were so many caribous. So since that time, since they started cutting logs here, then the animals, they're all gone. You could see here, around here there's all sand, mostly sand, because they're cut all clear cut. That's the reason we've been decided to come over here and start the blockade, because we're seeing what is going to happen in the future. In 1945, we were cutting. At that time, we didn't have no. We had crosscuts out there called 6-foot log. We have to cut them by hand, like. There was one of my friends. We stayed all winter in cutting logs. But we didn't cut all the trees that time because you have to, the bigger ones, that would, they choose the bigger ones. So we, and some people went We used to use horses to pull them out from the, pull them in the skidways, you know. And we didn't cut all the trees. We didn't damage the land also, you know, because...
Leon Iron from Canoe Lake, and I'm 68 years of age. And this is part of the land where I used to trap, hunt. And around me here for maybe miles here, there's no trees, you know. It's just a clear-cut area. Sand, just a few grass starting to grow after 6 years. 6 years ago, this used to be a beautiful forest country. Wildlife used to be here, moose, deer, and everything. Well, as far as you can see, there is none of that wildlife anymore. Disappeared because of the clear cutting. It's a sad scene to be around here, you know, and you know at one time that this place was beautiful with trees, beautiful with birds and animals, and nothing can survive here. The wild rice is being grown on in water, and you know, it's only germinate when it have a certain temperature in the spring there, you know. If it gets too hot right away, you know, and then warm in the summer, then the wild rice might not be as good as it would be, you know. And the only way to do that is to have a shelter around the lake, you know, from trees that are standing. But then what they're doing to those wild rice patches, they're just cutting trees right close to the water, and that makes it wide open for the sun to penetrate into the lake and make it very hot, warm water, and that's then not very good for growing wild rice. And that's how the damage or slows down the growth of wild rice.
Oh, Canada. Our home and native land. 100,000 years. We've walked upon your sands. With saddened hearts. We've seen you robbed and stripped of everything you prized. While they cut down the trees, we were shunted aside to the jails and the penitentiaries. Oh, Canada. We sympathize with thee. Oh, Canada. We stand on guard for thee.
My name is Lester House. I'm Plains Cree Indian person now living in the Rocky Mountains. Not too long ago, a friend who was very perceptive in the world of science said they sunk a hole in the earth somewhere in Greenland, and now the scientists have ascertained that the earth is actually a living orb. You know, and we've always known this. We grew up knowing this. And it's not something that is explained to us. It's something that we know. It's something that we naturally know. And with that kind of knowledge, it empowers us. It empowers us to connect with the earth spiritually. And that is our source of power. You show me a culture on this earth that is actually going to survive without the earth. The earth is our culture. The earth is our culture. that goes for everyone on this earth. Everyone. You know, you can dictate what a people's culture is and books or whatever, but it doesn't mean anything. When it comes down to it, the earth is the basis for all cultures, you know, or way of life. Without the earth, what have you? You've got no culture to speak of. So for us to dishonor the earth is to commit cultural genocide, cultural suicide, if you will. Our people have tried to explain that to the European people for a long time since they arrived here. We talked about Mother Earth and that our very lives depend on the earth. The earth is the one that feeds us. The earth, to my people, is our first mother, because the earth gave life to our mothers, you see. So the earth is our first mother, you know. So to join the industrial system is to declare war against our own mother. That is insane to our culture. It's insane. It's us committing suicide.
Chief Seattle told the people that were going to buy his land that you want to buy my land, but do you want to buy the sky also? And do you want to buy the water and the rivers? If you can buy my land, what else do you want to buy? And he said, if the white man doesn't watch out, he's going to die in his own shit. That's 100 years ago. You know, and nobody has taken his message seriously till now. And I think people might be almost coming to us too late. I think we want to save the environment too, and if people had come to us sincerely, I don't think you're going to get too many Native people or Aboriginal people turning them down. We'll do the best we can and use whatever resources we have to help fight the destruction of the creation. When I look at environment, it's a holistic thing. It's the whole creation that you're fighting for. And that's what we have to realize, is that, you know, you're not just saving that river. You're saving the fish that eat in there. And you're saving everything that's been created for the use of all animals. And that's the important thing that we have to keep in mind, is that it's not just for man. Yeah? We shouldn't be just doing this selfishly for man, but for all animals and all generations of people and animals and other animals. Whether it's the winged or the two-legged or whatever, they're all sacred to us. And we have to look at the sacredness of everything. And I think that's what society has lost. It has lost the awe of creation. They'll say we can make a bomb that can destroy everything, but they can never make a bomb that can create anything but havoc.
They say that the whole desire to dominate, to oppress, conquer, is a very male energy. And they say that, people say, that through the Industrial Revolution we've developed ways and means of not only polluting the earth but killing ourselves at even faster rates. I believe that we have to start listening to the trees again. Let's start listening to what the waters are saying, to what the air is speaking.
Just think, when you wake up and the first thing you do is wash your face with the beautiful sacred water. And the next thing you do is you fry up some bacon and eggs. You're eating another life. If for a few minutes in the morning, if you take a few minutes of your time to respect and honor those things that give you life, I think this environment thing would be a very minimum problem.
You've been listening to The Sweetgrass Road, one of 32 narrationless voice scapes produced by yours truly, me, back in the early 1990s. Listen to it again and learn about the people you've just heard at greenplanetmonitor.net.
We watch them come and watch them go. We watch them kill the buffalo. Kill our lakes and poison our streams. But they can never kill our native dreams. Destroying the land. It's a crime. Financial suicide. It's just a matter of time.
In today's episode of the Earth Chronicles, you heard music from Four Little Feathers, Carlos Nakai and William Eaton, Buffy St. Marie, Willie Dunn, and A la la Montagne. Environmental Suicide was written and performed by Mark Beachy and Rick Waddell. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. If you appreciate what you're hearing, help us out. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories and subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Every listener matters, and we're here because of listeners like you. Thank you for all your support.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As Hurricane Milton barreled towards Florida in 2024, many counties across the state issued mandatory evacuation orders. But several jails in those areas did not evacuate the people incarcerated there. Similar events have been reported during Hurricane Helene in North Carolina, Hurricane Harvey in Texas, and other disasters. Environmental and disaster sociologist Maggie Leon Corwin says there's no standardized nationwide protocol for evacuating prisons and jails. Policies vary, and many facilities lack adequate ways to safely evacuate.
What we've heard a lot is that there's not maybe enough buses or vans, that other places nearby that would be secure enough to hold folks who are incarcerated in a secure fashion don't have the space.
So sometimes people are left behind without a way to communicate with loved ones. And in some cases, they've endured flooded cells, a loss of running water, or extended power outages. So she says governments should develop comprehensive procedures and plans for keeping incarcerated people safe as climate change causes more extreme weather.
It's really important that we not leave anyone behind, and certainly not behind bars.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
It's back to school season. If you have unused tech in your home or office, consider donating it to BC Technology for Learning Society so schools, nonprofit organizations, and low-income individuals can have better access to technology. Donating is safe, easy, and helps people in your community. If you want to donate or to request refurbished equipment, you can learn more at reusetechbc.ca.